Welcome to the Opium Den. I'm Daniel Williams. Well, thanks for joining me this evening. Another beautiful Thursday down here in Southwest Florida. And from talking to my friends across the country today, it appears that Southwest Florida had the most beautiful and the most warm weather of any place out there. So lucky us, and I hope you're warm and if you're snowed on, at least you're not snowed in, and life is going as it can for you up in all the cold weather. So bundle up and stay warm, and try not to hate us for living down here in Southwest Florida, which is always a paradise, but at this particular time of the year, it is a most desirable paradise. So stay warm, and thanks for tuning in tonight. Now, my faithful listeners, the five or six of you that are out there, know about our sweet little 11-year-old chocolate lab named Bahama. And you knew that 3 weeks ago she had surgery on her right ear for a hematoma, which is a blood/fluid swelling. And this happened in her right ear. So we had to have that operated on 3 weeks ago, and today, 3 weeks exactly after her surgery, she had all of her stitches taken out of her right ear, and the vet said it looked really good and it should solve the problem. But Bahama was really excited when we got home today, because I think she sensed that she could finally go back into the pool. The vet said no baths and no swims in the pool until her stitches were out. So I think she got pretty excited as we came back in the house. Of course, she's always excited when she comes back from the vet. She doesn't like the vet that much. I mean, she's very docile and sweet, but it scares her shitless. So we came back and rushed to the lanai door, opened up, and she ran out, jumped in the pool, swam around a little bit, jumped out, ran around, jumped in, jumped out, jumped in, jumped out. So she was feeling pretty happy today. So thanks for all the karma sent Bahama's way. Again, her ear is looking really good, and she got all of her stitches out today. So, and she's probably gained a few pounds because the drugs that they gave her, a prednisone and an antibiotic of some sort, gave her quite the appetite. So she's been off the pills for a few days, and once they completely wean out of her system, I think her appetite will be back to pre-surgery days. So anyway, Bahama's doing great. Beautiful day down here. Again, thanks for joining us tonight here inside the Opium Den. And tonight we have a guest on the show, and we're looking forward to speaking with her. Jody James is her name. And Jody is a drug policy advocate down here in the state of Florida, although she has worked on national campaigns. She was the former executive director for the Florida Cannabis Action Network, and most recently spent 4 years working with LEAP, which is the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition group out there. So, again, she's been a long-time activist. And since those 4 years with LEAP, she has worked in various grassroots campaigns, including Journey for Justice, and one that I'm going to have her talk about because I think it sounds like it was a lot of fun. Another grassroots campaign was the Haunted Drug Czar Project. I'm personally interested in hearing some of the more sordid details of haunting our drug czar. And that particular campaign led to a website, which is www.adrugwarcarol.com. And that talks about the experience of the Haunted Drug Czar Project. So we're going to give Jody a call here. And get her views on her, we'll get her insights over her past experience with drug policy work and where she believes the state of drug policy is now, and what the future holds for drug policy work going forward. There's been some interesting developments in drug policy of late, and we're going to talk about some of those with Jody as well. So sit back, load the bong, take a big hit, turn the heat up if you need to, and we hope you enjoy our conversation tonight with Jody James. So we're going to click the old Skype machine button and hope that we can get Jody on the line here in a second. As I always do, I spoke to her earlier for a sound check, so I'm...
Good evening, Daniel.
Well, hello, Jody. How are you?
Well, I'm wonderful. Thrilled to be here this evening with you.
Well, we're glad to have you inside the Opium Den tonight. We appreciate you taking time out of what I know is a busy week to spend some time with us and talk about our favorite subject here inside the Opium Den, and that's drug policy. So we're in friendly territory tonight, Jody. So what I wanted to... I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was going to tell you how exciting it the idea of being in the Opium Den. I just want to snuggle up on a comfortable pillow and just get it all out.
Well, that's the rumor of what Opium Dens are all about, although actually that's the truth. The old-time Opium Dens were a very social environment, but you know how the drug prohibitionists attacked it as a place where all of these... opium addicts were luring in white women to have their way with them. But in actuality, the Opium Dens of past were a very social social area. But anyway, pardon me?
A social safe place.
A social safe place, and that's what the Opium Den here, we are a social safe place. So we're going to speak our mind tonight, and hopefully... entertain and inform the three people that are listening out there tonight.
Well, Mo, Larry, Curly, thanks for your support.
Yeah, right. Exactly right, Jody. So listen, I wanted to, I introduced you at the top of the hour to everyone, gave some of your bona fides, and but I mentioned that I didn't get a chance to look up the Haunted Drug Czar Project website. So I wanted to actually talk to you about that and what prompted that, how it worked, and how much fun you had. So fill us in on the Haunted Drug Czar Project, if you would.
Ah, the Haunted Drug Czar Project really was a lot of fun. I'm a firm believer that everybody can have a voice in this issue, that there's a place for everyone, that all you need to do is find your niche and express yourself. And the Haunted Drug Czar Project took on way, way more dimension than we ever would have expected. It was really pretty simple. Florida had its own drug czar. The other 50 states share a drug czar. We have a new one. Chief Gill from Seattle is now our national drug czar. But at the time, it was Barry McCaffrey. Was our national drug czar, and James McDonough had just been appointed by Jeb Bush to be the Florida State Director of Drug Control. So I thought we were pretty fortunate down here. We had our own, and all the other 49 states had to share one.
Well, that's because we're special, Jody.
We are special. We are, and I think when more people get a hold on that, times will change. I'm there. But I sent an email to James McDonough right after he was... appointed to this very important position to direct drugs in Florida. And I said, I just wanted to let you know that we're going to be every place you are until we're confident that you're not going to be treating patients and caregivers with military tactics and techniques. And I signed my little name, and my bona fide at the time was with the Coalition Advocating Medical Marijuana. That was a little paid position, my first paid drug policy reform position. We didn't have a lot of people, but we had some really serious people. And we used Freedom of Information to find out where the Florida Director of Drug Control was going to be. And any citizen has access to these records. There was nothing special about us. We didn't have to be some big corporation. I'm not an attorney. I am just a citizen who has the right to know where my elected officials are going to be.
So once, you knew where our own little drug czar was going to be, what did you do? Did you follow him around? Did you dress up? What did you do?
Yes.
To all the yes to everything. Huh?
We did whatever it took to make sure that we were confident that he was not going to use military tactics and military techniques.
Yeah, but that didn't you kind of know that, you know, he was going to anyway? I mean, did you really think that it would actually work to the extent that he would back off on some of the more draconian tactics that have been employed since and then?
Well, you know, I am naive. I really do believe that if enough people get up and stand up in a democracy, that our leaders will follow.
Oh, I understand that, but I'm asking specifically on following our Florida drug czar around. What were the, you know, give us a couple of examples of where you followed him to and what transpired and whether or not it made much of a difference.
Well, when we would find out that he was going to be getting on the plane in Tallahassee to go to an event in Key West, we might have one person standing there at the gate that says, "Stop arresting medical marijuana patients." And one person in that room in Tallahassee or that room in Key West when he got off the plane saying, "Stop arresting medical marijuana patients." We followed him to the Peabody Hotel in Orlando and actually got him outside in front of a group of reporters with patients where the Associated Press quoted him as saying that medical marijuana was akin to witchcraft, folklore, and home remedy.
Is that on YouTube? Or was that just audio only?
It ended up in print. Associated Press printed it. But I've got the videotape of it, and one of the projects that I've kind of been working on in what we call my spare time is getting some of these old archives out there. But it was effective. The Florida Director of Drug Control went on to become the Florida Secretary of Prisons and ultimately recommended large amounts of prisoners being released because overcrowding. He's come 180 degrees when it comes to things like treatment and provisions for people. And ultimately, he sent me an email one time recommending that I tell my patients to use vaporizers because it was less harmful than smoking. So, you know, we ended up having a great relationship with the guy. And I think that, I mean, we were tough on him. He would pick up his napkin at a luncheon, and he would find a pamphlet sitting there that said, "Stop arresting medical marijuana patients," or "Marijuana for medicine." Because at the time, we were not well-funded, and we didn't have a lot of friends in high places, but we certainly had a lot of high friends in places. So we were able to get behind the scenes and get his schedule and really just be where he was. And as a result, a friend of ours of the Florida Cannabis Action Network did a really great comic book that your listeners, if they haven't seen, should check out. And that's A Drug War Carol. It was written by a lady by the name of Susan Wells, and she takes on the drug war in the theme of the Dickens Christmas Carol.
Right.
So you literally have a cartoon. It's a little cartoon storybook. It's available online at drugwarcarol.com, where you meet the ghost of Christmas, of Prohibition past, present, and future. So that was another variation on the haunted drug czar.
So let me ask you about this drug czar. What I mean, I remember when Jeb Bush appointed him, and I didn't really follow really closely. How long did he last, and where is he now, and do we still have a Florida drug czar?
We still have a Florida drug czar. I guess I'm starting from your last question and work my way back.
That's all right.
We still have a Florida drug czar. Today, The man's name is Janus, and he's really comes from the treatment side of things. Our first drug czar, Director McDonough, he was a military man in Vietnam and had moved through public policy and worked in the National Office of Drug Control. So he really came into it with a military background, which was part of the reason why we chose to call him on military tactics.
Right.
But he was smart, a real smart character. It seems to me that he stayed in the Office of Drug Control probably until 2004, 2005, when he moved to Secretary of Corrections. Now, it was when he started talking about releasing nonviolent offenders that he found himself no longer a Florida secretary. And I believe he's a consultant, though, now, and really talking about alternatives to incarceration, because we simply cannot spend another $19 billion on prison. And, you know, that's not unique to Florida. I know we're kind of being Florida-centric here because we can. But the crisis of building prisons are not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. So that's something that all of our governments are needing to look at right now.
Well, let's
go ahead.
Thanks. let's move past Florida for a bit. We can come back as it gets tangentially important for us to do so. But let's move out onto the national scene and talk about what insights you've gained since working 4 years with LEAP and being a part of the Florida Cannabis Action Network. What your experiences have been and how you think drug policy stands now, and what do you think we need to do in the future? So, what's your take on the experience that you had, and how is it guiding you for what you want to do today?
Well, those are some pretty weighted thoughts. And
well, I just got some really good pot today, so.
All nice and mellow in the opium den tonight, I see.
Well, that's the idea, at least on paper. But go ahead, sorry.
working at the national level, international level, with law enforcement against prohibition was an extremely important consulting job contract, and I've worked with a number of nonprofit organizations working on different drug policy projects over the years, and done some local consulting on political campaigns and things like that. So where I think the movement needs to go, if there is such a thing as a movement for this, is back to the local communities. Really, politics are local. We've worked at the national level, and there's certainly changes happening all around us. I read something about Czechoslovakia is now going to allow 5 plants.
Exactly. But back with your time at LEAP, tell us what years those were, and why they fired Howard.
Well, because really they were short-sighted. That's why they fired Howard. That's an important project that he has going on there in Washington, D.C., and I'm hoping to keep him busy, actually, over the next couple of years. I was working with LEAP in a variety of capacities from 2005 until currently, and they recently had a shakeup, and there were some changes, and basically the organization is going to be really centered right there in Boston. All of the staff, at one point we had a very staff that was scattered across the country, and we were really bringing a lot of things to the table. And they decided to go a different direction, they being the executive director. And he was never really fond of Howard's project. For those who don't know, Howard Wooldridge is a cop. He was a cop in Michigan. He was also a cop in Texas. And in 2002, Howard helped found Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
And that was after he ate a bunch of mushrooms, right? Is that the right story? He saw the light, or you know.
The red pill or the blue pill.
What turns some of these cops? I mean, it's pretty funny, you know. I mean, yeah, the old adage, once a cop, always a cop. And now I find it absolutely surreal that those who share most of my views in drug policy used to be cops, the same ones that, you know, chased me down, put me in handcuffs, and threw me in jail a couple of times. So it's a little strange situation, but interesting nonetheless.
Well, it was always fun for me working for law enforcement against prohibition, because when I did my grassroots activism, and as I was coming up in the movement, I was always the person in front of the cop with my finger in their face while the other 40 people stood behind me and waited to see what was going to happen. So it was really funny, because when I started working for LEAP, I would get out there and I would tell these cops what to do, and where used to they would threaten to arrest me, now they would thank me and give me a paycheck. So I always thought that was kind of a nice turn of events. But LEAP really wants to work internationally, and I really think that the drug policy that we need to be working on today, that the investors in this country that can afford to give $5 or $50 or $500, that what we need to be doing is working on some smart strategic campaigns that are going to affect public opinion at the local level, and that can be translated then into political power in Washington, D.C. This is a war. It wasn't my idea to call it a war. I was drafted long before I was born. I was born in 67. So this had been going on.
You're still a pup.
But, you know, I've been a casualty of war all my life, and I refuse to be a victim. So somewhere along the line, either I got into the war on drugs or the war on drugs got into me. And at this point, I'm like, I don't understand why the national movement hasn't taken a look at the battlegrounds and said, okay, these are the mines that we have to move, and if these mountains won't move, we will move these mountains.
Well,
and I don't see a hard line like that.
Well, as it relates to national policy and moving the drug debate forward, you mentioned earlier medical marijuana. You had worked with that on the Haunted Drug Czar project. And I believe, and it's not the prevailing view inside drug policy reform leadership now, but I believe that medical marijuana is the wrong strategy to move the drug debate forward. And I'm just wondering if that's not the reason why we have yet to progress past the area we are now. I mean, when you look at other countries, when you look at Portugal and the Netherlands and more recently Mexico, these countries have much more enlightened drug policies than we do. And it didn't start with any type of grassroots movement for medical marijuana. It came from national leadership realizing that, and without putting too fine a point on it, that recreational drug users posed little or no threat. So when we speak of the national issue and LEAP's message, which is to repeal drug prohibition across the board, which I said, you know, aligns with mine, what are your thoughts of medical marijuana as a strategy to move the drug debate forward?
I'm not sure whose idea it ever was to divide the drug debate into all these, the drug policy debate into all these sub-issues, but I think it was a bad idea. I believe that I'm like most people, and that is that the first introduction I had was medical marijuana. I was in a legislator's office one time, and I was with a patient who truly needs this as medicine. No question about it. Her doctor agrees.
Yeah, I don't want to debate the efficacy of cannabis as a medicine, because I think that's settled within most people's minds. I want to look at it from the perspective as a strategy to move the drug debate forward.
Well, and my point was that the legislative aide looked at me and he said, Jody, I've seen your website. You don't want marijuana as medicine. You want to legalize all marijuana. And as I have become involved in the discussion, as I have seen the tentacles that prohibition has, the danger that comes from prohibition, I've joined your camp. I can't go back and talk about marijuana as an issue or really talk about anything other than the public safety and the economic argument for ending prohibition and changing a whole range of policies dealing with the way we treat people and the way they deal with drugs. As a strategy, I think dividing the issue up is really allowing the opposition to conquer us.
Excuse me?
I think that we're kind of giving the opposition, the people who would keep all drugs illegal, I think we're giving them an opportunity to conquer us by dividing the issue into so many little parts and pieces. Congress passed a bill that's going to allow them to start funding needle exchange, and it's going to allow them to start implementing a medical marijuana bill in Washington, D.C., and people are talking about that as a victory, and while it may very well be a small victory that affects a few people, it took 10 years to do that, and I wonder if we had been going at the heart of the matter. Prohibition does not make us safer. Our current policies are wasting our resources. They're not effective. People who support the current structure are supporting cartels. They're supporting death due to bad drugs and adulterated substances, and they're giving control of the marketplace to criminals.
So,
and anytime, when you say something other than that, what do you have?
So we have our drug policy leaders, Ethan Nadelman, at the DPA, and Rob Campea at Marijuana Policy Project, and Alan St. Pierre at Normal, and they seem to be primarily focused on medical marijuana. So how do we convince them that this strategy is a failing strategy, and what are we going to do when let's make the assumption that marijuana becomes a settled law across the country? All of these guys believe that repealing drug prohibition is the end game. So what will they do next? What drug will they champion next? It seems like they're painting themselves into a corner with drug policy fixated on medical marijuana, and then our opponents, the prohibitionists, will be able to say, once they move on to their next drug or what class of drugs, our opponents will be able to say, see, we told you so. Medical marijuana is a Trojan horse to drug legalization, and they'll be right. So, how do we, the foot soldiers in this situation? How do we convince our leadership that they're barking up the wrong tree?
Struggled with that question for the last couple months and ultimately decided that I was going to start a new organization, a new national 501c3 that was going to talk about the larger issue of drug prohibition and really support that message. Law enforcement against prohibition is a great idea. Putting cops out there talking about this is a great way to introduce the subject. But you have a whole cross-section of people who don't understand how this policy affects them.
I think a lot of people do understand how the policy affects them in a more general way. And if they've had people within their family or circle of friends who've been caught up in the and arrested for drugs, then they have a more specific understanding. But I don't think it's really the people in the country that aren't ready to have the discussion. I think it's the people in our drug policy leadership that believes they're not ready to have that discussion. Therefore, they won't. But, with your idea to start another 501c3, I'm wondering, if you look at LEAP, which gives the same opinion and the same policy recommendation that your group would, how do you feel you would be able to set yourself, any new 501c3, to set themselves apart or become more well-known than LEAP is? I mean, after all, these guys have been at it for a while.
Well, that's always the challenge with a new organization. I think that you will set yourself, that we will set ourselves apart through our successes. And that, you know, when I was talking about this is a war and we need to be talking about strategically taking ground and then communicating that with Congress, I think that once you start to see areas where politicians, and there's kind of some roadmaps that we need to start seeing, and then we'll know we're having successes. Right now, there was a poll that came out today, and I don't always put a lot of faith in polls, but there was a poll that came out today that said that about 10% of people would consider legalizing a drug other than marijuana. But in the poll today, and it was only 1,000 people, but it was supposed to be representative of the nation, they said 53 supporting legalizing marijuana. So I'm with you. I think that that's kind of a settled issue. People get that the laws are going to start to shuffle their way into place. We need to educate people on the broader effects of the policy, and we need to motivate them. There's a whole huge amount of people out there who are interested in this issue, who get it, but who are not part of, quote-unquote, the drug policy reform movement. So I think we need to find them.
I think that's where you and I might have a slight difference in understanding. I believe the people are more than ready to have this discussion. You know, polls are important. We like the ones that support our positions, and we don't like the ones that don't, obviously. But you know, this whole I just got a message from one of our listeners. He said, "I'll be right back. I have to go grab another beer." But I think that we have an educated population. I think that they're not emboldened to speak their mind. But I think it's settled with the majority of people. But a Zogby poll, and again, polls are polls. But if you ask the question as flatly as possible, which this Zogby poll did, 76% of the American public believe that the drug war had failed. Not that it was failing, but that it had failed. I think the problem that, aside from using medical marijuana as a strategy, I think we should go and directly attack our Congress folks and, you know, pull their pants down or blow their skirt up, depending upon their gender, in public, and make them and demand that they defend their positions on keeping drugs illegal and in the hands of our children via the unregulated black market. Do you think that's a pretty good tactic? I mean, think people would support that?
I think that's a great tactic. I think that we absolutely have to do that. But that's that has to be, I guess it doesn't have to be, but I see that as something that is happening at the constituent level. And so when I talk about the grassroots level, and the education that needs to be happening at home, and that's that community-based calling these guys out at home in front of their peers. I had a lot of fun with Congressman Rick Keller. Again, I worked on medical marijuana for a while, and Rick Keller, I took some petitions to a town hall meeting with Rick Keller and publicly asked him if he would support a medical marijuana bill in Congress, and he thanked me for being there, very politely thanked me for being there. And then he told me that he would not support that if you were interested in marijuana, he was not your man. He would not support medical marijuana for a sick person any more than he would support giving a joint to a death row prisoner for their last hurrah.
Well, fuck him then. I mean,
well, you know what? That's what we did. But what we did is we sent letters to the people who were giving him money, because that's public record.
Right.
And we said, if you or someone you love have one of these terrible illnesses and you think marijuana might be good for them, then don't vote for Rick Keller because he's not your man. You absolutely have to out him, but you have to out him with the people that support him. I don't want to educate a million people. I want to educate enough people to get the right people in Congress and move this issue and be done with the war on drugs. That's what I want. I think we agree with that.
We do agree with that. But it's just it's a matter of execution that makes the difference in the final analysis. And like I said, I believe that the American public is if they may not be longing for this discussion, many of them are, but if they're not longing for it, they're most at minimum they're ready to have it. If you look at the history of drug policy and drug use back in the 60s, when most of it when the counterculture first began, and a lot of pot and a lot of LSD, it was a very defined game of us against them. But now, 40 years later, recreational drug use is now multi-generational. We have boomers, their kids, and even some of their grandkids that are living active and productive lives, and they're tired of being chased by the police. And I think that lends itself to the to that 76% number. So as far as educating a lot of people, I think the education should be in the vein of going after politicians. Democrat, Republican, there isn't an elected official up in Congress that hasn't voted to continue draconian drug policies. So I think if we make them defend their positions, our Congress folks, if we make them defend their positions, that will make it a little easier for those who hold positions similar to yours and mine to speak up. Because most of them, even though 76% believe the drug war has failed, they don't like to, they're uncomfortable talking about it in public, because even though 76% believe that, only 25% of people who share your, my opinion think that, people that share your opinion and mine think there's only 25% of people that support them. So it's kind of a silent, frightened majority. So giving them the opportunity to express views they already have may be most easily obtained by going after our elected officials and demanding that they defend their drug policy votes.
Well, I've wondered how you do that as a 501c3 and still keep your 501c3. And I definitely think that there is a place for more campaign election engine, electronic engineering, whatever they call those committees. And it differs from state to state. But absolutely, I think that's strategy. Now, what we did was truth police. And you can do truth police as a 501c3, or you can do truth police as an individual. You ask what we, those of us who believe in this but may not be affiliated with one of these other organizations. Truth police was extremely effective. And it was one of those projects that we did that actually got picked up and got replicated elsewhere. But, a simple series of three questions that you want to ask in a town hall meeting. And it's best if you have more than one person to go with you, and you should all have the same three questions. So we actually would ask people to go out and do truth police, and we would get four or five people together. One school of thought that says you should all wear the same T-shirt or something like that. I'm not in that school of thought. I think you'll have a better chance of getting your question, getting chosen to ask a question if you're scattered about the room. But if you all have the same three questions, then if question one gets asked and you get called on, you have question two. And ask them these questions. You're right. Not one Republican... not one Republican in Florida voted to authorize this medical marijuana vote in D.C. or to fund needle exchange. Let's call them on it. But I think the real question that needs to be asked is, why is it that you support cartels being in charge of a drug market? And do you think that with 8% of the population over the age of 12 using drugs this month, illegally this month, can we ever arrest our way out of the problem? I like those questions.
Okay, we have a comment here from one of our listeners. I'm going to read it over the air and we'll comment. This is from my friend Randall Miller, and it says, I disagree with your position on the incremental approach. I don't think that pro-prohibition folks will see things as Trojan horses. On the contrary, I think after they see that nothing happens when they decriminalize soft drugs like marijuana, like here in Massachusetts, where evidently a big chunk of the state has always smoked pot, they will be more likely to extend the repeal. Trying to repeal all drug laws at once just doesn't seem realistic to me. Just my two pesos, Daniel. Well, Randall is a very smart fellow, and he's got a website, randallhmiller.com. He's a former Army officer, Special Forces officer, and he is a terrorism expert. And he's been on the show as well, and he was just coming in here. So here we have, an individual who believes the drug war is wrong, but also believes in the incremental approach. What would you say to Randall Miller, Jody?
Well, when I ran for office in 2002, I ran for Florida State House, and I would go out and I would talk about drug policy as a healthcare and education issue, and I would talk about an incremental approach. And people would come up to me and say, you know what, I think we should legalize all drugs. When Randall talks about decriminalizing marijuana, I think, well, then who's going to provide it? And as long as we haven't created a mechanism where we have control over the efficacy and the purity and the marketplace, we're always going to have a drug problem. So incremental approaches.
Well, what do you think about his point that the drug prohibitionist won't come back on us and accuse us of using medical marijuana as a Trojan horse. Now, currently, right now, there are conversations out in California about this, that people who bought into the idea that that marijuana was used medicinally by very sick people, and then they didn't pay much attention to it. And now there's a tremendous amount of attention being placed on it in California. And part of that debate is that just about anybody, literally anybody, can get a recommendation for medical marijuana, and that the general public is beginning to look at it and go, wait a minute, I thought this was for like AIDS patients and people with multiple sclerosis and glaucoma and nausea from chemotherapy. What's going on now that everybody can get it? So I think that argument is already being waged in California, and they are starting to see a backlash. Do you think that that's just an anomaly, or you think that's what's down the road for us?
Absolutely think that's what's down the road for us. And that's why when you talk about prohibition as a policy, first of all, most people, when you use the word prohibition, recognize that the last time we tried that policy, it didn't work. And when you talk about prohibition, the association is guys with Tommy guns and corrupt law enforcement and people dying from bathtub gin and shootouts in the street for territory. And when I talk to you about prohibition, those are the same things that I can say about modern prohibition. We have people shooting each other out in the streets. I'm not a lawmaker, and nor am I a public safety expert. I believe that there are people who will have those conversations. But until we have addressed the root problem, and that is zero tolerance, total prohibition, we can't have the conversation about what regulations are ultimately going to make us safer. And whether you want to do drugs or don't want to do drugs, at the end of the day, we want it to be safer. We want tomorrow the sun to rise and for our kids to be safe. And if there's a little bit more money in our pocket, great. And if our job's still there, even better. But the first thing you want to do is wake up. And so we need to be practicing policies today that make tomorrow safer. Prohibition is not that policy. And talking about anything else just doesn't give enough weight to the issue.
Well, I have found, Jody, when speaking to individuals about repealing drug prohibition, one of the more important components of that conversation is to draw a picture for them, paint a picture of what a a post-repeal world would look like. So that's, I think that's the hardest issue. They may feel that we're doing things wrong, but they don't know exactly what it would look like. And I think painting that picture is very important. What picture would you paint if you could, you know, give us your thoughts on what a controlled, regulated market would look like as opposed to what we have today? How would you sell that? How would you tell an individual, this is what it's going to look like? This is what will happen if we repeal drug prohibition. What picture do you paint, Jody?
Well, for me, I think it really begins with people understanding and getting better education about the drugs.
Let's make the assumption that they've made that commitment and they're willing to say, okay. You know, let's try a regulated marketplace. If they're willing to say that much, I don't know if they've thought that much farther. So they need to hear what that marketplace would look like. So let's make the assumption that they're already there. Paint the picture of what a regulated market would look like in American society.
So they've read your book and they know what all these different drugs do, right? And so they're not afraid of them anymore. I think a regulated market...
Well, I think they'll still be afraid of them to a certain extent, but you got to, you know, I'm sorry, but yeah, what would you tell them? What would it look like in your world?
Well, certainly cannabis would be treated more like alcohol and tobacco. Whether or not all drugs should be treated like alcohol and tobacco, I think ultimately that's the direction that I go. Any drug that is now available by prescription.
What would you tell them? Tell the person that how would we keep heroin and some of the hard drugs out of the hands of people who shouldn't do it? I mean, give specifics if you can on what you think that market, that infrastructure would look like to allay some of those fears.
Well, many of these drugs will be sold in pharmaceutical settings and pharmacy settings, and many of them would be sold in the state liquor store. I firmly believe that if I were having end-stage cancer, that heroin might very well be my drug of choice to take care of that condition, based on what I know about the effects of clean heroin on the body. And based on what I know the cost of heroin to be if it's created in a pharmaceutical setting. So under a regulated market where we are assuming that people can get good quality education about the drugs, most of these drugs would be handled in an over-the-counter setting. You would go in, I'm in favor of adult limits. I think there's certain things that kids don't need to do, so I definitely believe that these recreationally, at least, that these are adult decisions. If we're talking about a child that has a medical need for that's different. But you should be able to go in as an adult and buy just about any drug that you want. I think that's clear.
And yeah, I mean, I agree with you. You should be able to walk into a pharmacy and at least buy the narcotics, the opiates, and the stimulants, and as far as a distribution network based upon the state store model, whether it would be a state store or not, because not all states have state stores where they sell alcohol and the like. But
and not all counties are wet. Some counties are dry.
Right. So there would be individualized to a large extent. But your position would be that all these drugs would be available without prescription behind the counter from a pharmacist at CVS or Walgreens, right?
Well, and again, I may come down on the wrong side of the healthcare debate, but the idea that I have to go to a doctor to see a doctor because I need an antibiotic, maybe there's some wiggle room for all of these drugs. And drug policy is really about who controls the drugs, who controls the distribution and the marketplace, and who has access to them. And that's the real healthcare discussion we're having in America right now. So I think that this is a great time to be talking about drug policy, because it really is about a whole bunch of different drugs that we could have access to. But yes, I think that it would be an opportunity. Again, I'm in favor of age limits, but when it comes to cannabis, when it comes to MDMA, when it comes to probably LSD, like you said, a lot of the amphetamines, I think that some of the drugs would go away. I don't envision people making crank under a regulated market. And, you know, when you look at the way that the illegal cocaine is created and some of these illegal drugs are created and the chemicals that they use to make it, they're volatile and they're dangerous. And these things should be made in a laboratory with people who are skilled. And the prices of the drugs that we need or want should be affordable. So maybe, I don't know, is that the libertarian or the Democrat? I can't tell. But certainly as long as we have some people who have access to drugs and some people who don't have access to drugs, we're going to have a drug problem.
Well, what would you tell an individual if they asked you if you thought that drug use would increase with repealing drug prohibition? What would be your response to that?
We are certainly going to see more people being more open about being honest about their use. A friend of mine talks about homosexuality and when people started to recognize...
Okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I started to recognize homosexuality, and suddenly everybody was gay. And it really wasn't that everybody was gay. It was that people who may very well have been gay for a very long time were suddenly more open about it. Will drug use rise? Well, I was talking to a chief of police of Florida who said if marijuana was legal, he'd use it tomorrow. So I'm going to have to say at least by one.
Well, there's also the possibility that there could be a decrease because of the forbidden fruit aspect of it. It's not so cool anymore to do illegal drugs because it's mainstream. So there could probably be maybe not a corresponding decrease, but I think your police officer friend was kind of right on the money. I think there would be an increase. At least initially, and maybe would plateau at a higher level eventually. But I think there would be a certainly a high interest, no pun intended, in trying marijuana. I think a lot of people, I mean, half the adults in the country have already smoked it, and I think the other half wouldn't have much problem with it. I don't think it's the laws that are stopping them, but it might be helpful if there was no legal penalty for consuming pot. So I do think that there would be a slight rise there. But do you think people should be able to walk into Walgreens and buy a blister pack of 3 10-milligram Vicodins for, you know, $10? Would you envision that being a reality of repeal?
I think that at some point we're going to have to trust people to make some of these decisions. Because it's not fiscally responsible of us in a free society to do otherwise. We've gotten to the point, I was reading something in an article here in a local paper about a mom who gave her daughter a prescription pain pill, one, and the girl, because the girl had just gotten her braces adjusted or something stupid, the girl goes off to cheerleading practice and feels a little woozy. Cheerleaders, coach, does what she thinks is best and calls the ambulance. Daughter ends up in the hospital. Long story short, mom goes to jail. The prescription was something that a friend had left behind, and she gave her one of them. And it was something mild, and probably if she kept the child home and sent her to bed, no one would ever have been the wiser. But, you know, every day somebody's got a toothache and can't afford to see a dentist. And we are forcing that person to become part of an illegal, unregulated marketplace until such time that we make a 3-pack of Vicodin available for $10. But again, it needs to be alongside other less toxic alternatives, and the level of education has to be.
I don't think hydrocodone is all that toxic. I mean, it definitely will kill you in that regard, but everything has their death value. Do you think that, you know, pills like Vicodins, Percocets, do you think that they're dangerous drugs when used responsibly, or?
No.
Or do you think there's such a thing as using those drugs responsibly?
Absolutely. I think I have yet to see any drug that someone can't use responsibly. That someone may not be you, and that someone may not be me, but I've seen some amazing things. I never dreamed that I would be in a room with daily heroin users and be talking politics and being impressed as hell about the tactics that they were using.
The heroin addicts?
To protect their community. Heavens, yes. There's a huge
amount. Did you do any heroin with them?
It is not my drug of choice. And I did not. It was a really startling year. 2001 was a startling year for me. And part of it was being, I was in the marijuana movement. Do I have time for a story?
You have all the time you wish, hon. You got all the time you want, Jody. I'll just stick another quarter in the wave streaming machine and we'll just keep rolling with you, hon.
So I'm at a normal conference in Washington, D.C., and I have brought just a little bit of marijuana with me because I'm afraid to get where I'm going and not have access to marijuana. I'm far more afraid of getting where I am going and not having access to marijuana than I am of defending my having marijuana. So I'm in Washington, D.C., and a patient comes in, and he's from Washington, D.C., and he goes out the night before the conference to score some marijuana, and he gets into a cab with some guy. Long story short, the guy goes into a tenement building and never comes out. So here my friend is. He's a legitimate patient. He's in Washington, D.C., which should be his crib, and he's at a normal conference, and he gets ripped off trying to score weed. So I give him the little bit that I have, which is cool because I'm rooming with Jack Herer and you've got all the pot that I need. And maybe 3 months later, I go to a conference in Miami with the International Harm Reduction Coalition. And I'm a marijuana reformer, right? If those cocaine addicts want to get themselves together in organization and legalize cocaine, let them. This is 2001. I'm not as ignorant now. So I'm at the Harm Reduction Conference. And at the Harm Reduction Conference, the organizers have rented a suite as a safe injection room, and they are providing a nurse on duty 24 hours a day, paid for at the conference expense. They have secured a supply of clean needles, and they sent someone in a year prior to the conference to secure a clean supply of heroin to make sure that they had medicine available for the people who were there, who were daily injection users. And you know, I wasn't welcome to smoke my marijuana in their safe injection room, in their safe room. And that was my medicine, right? Right. Again, I've come a long way since then. But these are people who have access to a clean supply, have access to clean needles, and who are not stigmatized by their drug of choice, and who are able to lead totally productive lives. So I had quite an education that year. I came away really feeling differently about the broader drug policy, and it was intense because at the time in Florida, they were talking about giving the death penalty to people who were involved in giving ecstasy pills to someone who died. And so I ended up sitting in a room later that same week after the whole heroin injection thing. I ended up sitting in a room with two parents whose daughter had just died from an ecstasy overdose.
Whoa, wait a minute. Whoa. Okay, let me jump in real quick, if you don't mind. An ecstasy overdose?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and were they convinced?
Yeah, this was a real one. It took way too many pills. Way too many pills. And I don't believe that everything that is ever called an ecstasy death is an ecstasy death. I know better than that.
Yeah, most of them were dextromethorphan poisoning.
And polydrug overdose. Very rarely is ecstasy the only drug in their system. But there were some extenuating circumstances dealing with her health, too. And the main problem in this case that made it so grievous is the fact that the boyfriend didn't call for an ambulance, and she probably could have been saved. But his fear kept him from calling. But they wanted to give him they wanted to make it a death penalty case and try to make being involved in this, a death with a drug overdose, a death penalty case. And I started to realize these things and many, many more, that if I talked about the virtues of MDMA in treating post-traumatic stress or medical marijuana in treating ALS, that, like you said, I was sooner or later going to have to decide which drug I was going to champion next. And meanwhile, I was leaving out a whole cross-section of people who are using the drug successfully, and I am doing nothing to stop the crime and the violence that is associated with prohibition, which is where really the harm lies. All or nothing kind of girl.
Well, I'm an all or nothing kind of guy with regards to drug prohibition, obviously. I think it's important that we paint the proper picture to people out there, because they are ready to have these type of discussions. I don't know if we could actually get down to the minutia of explaining the pros of heroin addiction, and I don't say that demeaningly. I mean, there are pros of it, because people who are addicted to heroin, generally heroin makes them well. You know, they don't. As you mentioned, you were surprised at the level of intelligence in the room full of junkies. Once they get past that initial rush of opiates, crashing into their brain, they're relatively normal people by most visual standards. But I think that would be just a learning byproduct down the road. I don't know if we want to get that specific on the joys of heroin use or any particular IV use. But I've met, like you, I've met a large number of IV drug users. And, of course, it's been a drug policy conference, so you're going to get the cream of the crop, so to speak. But they're very articulate, and they're very informed. And many of them, despite the conventional wisdom, were, healthy people in the form of, they eat right, they would, exercise. You don't see a lot of fat heroin addicts anyway. I mean, they're mostly they're mostly kind of lean people, but you're right, they're normal people. Back before prohibition was enacted in 1914, there was a far smaller stigma on heroin addicts than there were on alcoholics. Alcoholics were viewed as a more dangerous, detrimental component to society than heroin users. So I think those things would work themselves out on a smaller, less visible scale, because the violence and everything associated with heroin, with the heroin trade, would disappear, and most heroin addicts, the functional ones, would be able to live a more anonymous life and a more settled and regular life, if they didn't have to get their drugs in the black market and the like. So let me ask this last question here and get your opinion on where do you think drug policy reform is headed? I mean, as an observer, I know what your desires and goals are, personally, to start a new 501c3, But where do you see drug policy today, and where do you see it in 5 years?
Well, I definitely think that we're going to have probably 25% of the country will be living under some sort of marijuana legalization scheme. Right now we have 25% living under a medical scheme. So I think that that's the direction that they're headed with marijuana. I think that's going to continue that trend. I don't see that going backwards. The violence associated with the war on drugs is starting to boil over our borders. So that discussion on stopping the violence at the border, how they decide they're going to stop the violence at the border, I think is going to really depend on where we go. Because we saw after 9/11 that the country had attached to the idea that drugs fund terrorism. And so long as we can keep countering that message along the border, and that's a pretty loud message. The media has really been behind us on it. If we can continue to keep the high ground on that message, then I think we'll see definitely a loosening on the marijuana laws, probably a loosening on some of the criminal penalties. The states are going to go that way towards decrim. But my guess is more and more money into interdiction. If we're not careful, we're going to spend a whole lot more money sending people to Afghanistan and a whole lot more money sending people to Colombia, kind of a trend towards getting it outside of our borders. So that's where our opportunity to educate people about how our drug policy is affecting foreign policy, that opportunity lies right there. But marijuana, domestic policy, domestic marijuana policies change rapidly. Foreign interdiction and foreign dollars spent rising. That's what I see.
Well, do you think Obama's our boy? Do you think he's going to be the one that makes significant change, or is he just giving us verbal blowjobs?
Well, right now I'd settle for a blowjob. Now he just snickers at me when I pull down my pants. oh, boy, you said I could say anything, right?
Anything and everything, Jody.
But, no, he's got to stop snickering. He's not my boy until he stops snickering. So marijuana's not funny, and drug policy is really serious, and I'm not any safer. And God, I don't want to go to Afghanistan to protect some guy's opium. I'm just not into that at all. No, I'm not convinced. In 2012, and I've been loyal to my party for a few years now, but in 2012...
Which party is that?
Well, I was raised... I joined the Democratic Party when I was 18, and I didn't know any better. I think I joined because my mom was a Republican, right? It kept balancing the universe. And then when I started to become politically aware, I had like this little D next to my name. And then I figured the Democrats have made as much of a mess as the Republicans have made. So as I have made my footprint in politics, I've stuck with the D. I figure it was my mess. I better clean it up.
Why aren't you a libertarian?
Well, you know, you're not the first person to ask me that. Probably because I think... no, I'm not going to say that. I'm really not going to say that.
Oh, please.
No, I say to my good, to only to my best libertarian friends, I say, because rotting bodies stink. And so I like...
What does that mean? I mean, I know what rotting... Well, I know that rotting bodies stink, but are you saying libertarians are rotting body?
Not at all. Hmm. I'm saying that I like having a government in place that makes sure that we're taking care of the least among us.
So why aren't you a libertarian? Fuck the big D, little D Democrat. You need to switch parties and be a libertarian.
Like I said, you are not the first person who said that. And you know, when I ran for office in 2002, was when in Florida they had their Full Slate project. So I was certainly invited to run on the Libertarian Party. Why am I not a Libertarian? I like public education, and you can't really be a good Libertarian and like public education as much as I do. Both of my kids are in public school.
Wait a minute. When you say you can't be a good Libertarian and love public education as much as you do, what does that mean? You think public education is right? I mean, does that mean you're against, like, charter schools and stuff like that?
I don't know where I come down on charter schools. I like the idea that everybody should be able to get the same basic education. And I know there's problems with that, and I know that teaching, dumbing down and teaching to the least of it, there's problems. But when it comes down to it, I'm really glad for my community school.
Do you have children? Do you have children in the school system?
I do.
How old are your kids?
They are 12 and 16.
Uh-huh.
I have two boys. And I've been glad. I believe that the best public school works when the parents are involved. So I've made sure that I have been. I chose carefully my community, knowing that was where I was going to send my kids to school. Now, that said, I chose to live in Florida, where education is like 49th in the nation. But, you know, they provide a small portion of what I consider my children's education.
What have you told your children regarding drugs? What's your children's drug education at this point? Because they're both certainly old enough to be fully aware and informed.
Oh, fully aware and informed. Let's see. What is their drug education? Prohibition doesn't work. That you need to be fully informed before you put anything in your body. That the best way to not need drugs is to make good choices first. So we have kind of a...
Wait a minute.
...relationship.
Doesn't that take away some of the truth behind the recreational enjoyment of certain drugs?
Well, we're not there yet. And I'm not sure. I don't know if everybody needs to use recreational drugs. I don't know. Some people grow up and are quite healthy and normal and never use recreational drugs. But I think that the way we think about drugs in our society is all wrong. So when my kids were little and they had an ache or a pain, the first thing I did was not give them a pill. The first thing I did was say, well, have you had enough water to drink to get the headache?
Have you told your children that smoking marijuana is no worse and sometimes better than alcohol? I mean, do they have an education in that regard that, you know, if they wanted to smoke pot, you wouldn't be against it?
At 16 and 12, I would counsel them against it. And I would...
assuming that, you know, 18, that type of deal where they're, you know, making more informed decisions because they're a little bit older. You wouldn't have any problem if at an age appropriate time they decided to experiment with recreational drugs.
No, probably not. I can't imagine one that I would have a problem with, provided that we were talking about someone who is acting like a responsible adult.
Are you going to let him hear this interview?
Yeah.
Just curious.
I told my 16-year-old I was nervous, and he came in and gave me a hug and said, "Don't worry about it, Mom. You're going to do great. You always do." So by the time my 16-year-old was 10 years old, he had been to more hemp fests than most people. When he started kindergarten, at the same elementary school that my oldest one is now a sixth grader, or my youngest one's a sixth grader at, I went in his first day of school, and I said, I wanted to let you know that I work on drug policy reform. This is the kindergarten teacher I'm talking to. And I said, my son knows people who have prescriptions for marijuana. They come to our home. Elvin Masika, Irv Rosenfeld were both Floridians at the time and had been in our home. I said, so when you start talking about drugs, and I know that you will, If it sounds like my son knows more about this than you think he should, you should listen to him because he probably got it from a doctor. And I still go in and volunteer in that kindergarten teacher's classroom.
Does she like to talk to the kids about drugs?
Well, it's not something I've ever asked.
I'm just kidding, Jerry.
Well, no, we were very successful in getting DARE removed from the school program. We don't fund DARE in this county anymore because it doesn't work. And while, you know, kids need drug education, and I'm not arguing with that, they need drug education that is honest. And that's the thing that I love. My 16-year-old came up to me and tells me when kids are inviting his friends to use drugs and when his friends are having issues. And I'm the mom that if somebody's having a real problem, that my son will say, well, you should come home and talk to my mom. And I think the reason is because I don't lie to them about this stuff. And when you tell them or you sugarcoat them or you think you're protecting them by not giving them the full truth, then they just realize you're a hypocrite and a liar. And if you lie about one thing, what else did you lie about? And then you can't be trusted. So hopefully I won't be that person over 40 that you just can't trust.
Well,
I know on this issue we've got the right idea.
Yeah, and it was back in the 60s. They said don't trust anybody over 30, I think it was, but maybe today's 40s, yesterday's 30, I don't know. But I do have a great respect for you in the context of teaching your children and having those honest discussions about drugs. I did the same thing with my son, who's now 29 years old, and as soon as he was old enough to comprehend these subjects, and my wife finally let me know where he was. But I've had these discussions with my son from about the age of 11 on. I think it was our first conversation we were able to have. And he's a 29-year-old kid. He's a fairly well-adjusted, fairly sober kid. He smokes pot on occasion. He drinks alcohol on occasion, but mostly he's comfortable and never felt pressured by his peers. And I think that's probably the most important thing we can teach our children, not just about drugs, but about other age risky activities. So I have a lot of respect for you in the fact that you taught your children better than the just say no in the DARE programs that so many other kids get and don't get any feedback from their parents. And what about their father? Is he in the same camp with you?
Yeah, their dad is my ex-husband, but he had been an old marijuana reformer. So we knew when we had the kids that we were going to raise them being a little more enlightened about some of these substances than we had been. Now I'm remarried, and their stepdad is also a reform-minded person and very supportive of my actions and my activities, and certainly is a light. And he understands and supports what we're doing with the kids. But again, we don't have a mentality in our house where drugs of any sort is the first line of defense. And I think that's really important. You know, someone who looks at their kids from over the wine glass and says, don't do drugs, and then goes to the medicine cabinet and grabs a sleeping pill before they go out drinking.
Well, that's just the hypocrisy that children see through, you know, quite rapidly and readily. Now, I'm not trying to out you or anything, but If you were a consumer of recreational drugs at this point, would your children know?
The next time I do LSD, I am not going to announce it before I do it.
Well, that's I didn't actually mean in real time, but I mean if you happen to be a recreational drug user at this juncture in your life, would your children know about that in general, as opposed to specifically, hey, I'm going to take 300 micrograms of LSD tomorrow, so, you know, go to the park. I mean, that was my question. I mean, you know, would you be that honest if in fact that was your situation? Would they know about it, is my question.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's sometimes the simplest answers are the best. Yeah, that they would be aware that their mother is a participant, and they should be okay with that. I mean, if you're giving them the right information, they shouldn't have a problem with the truth as it extends to the rest of the family. Well, Jody,
it comes back to safety, and if your kids feel safe and loved and protected, they can be really, really understanding of us. I'm better for my children, and hopefully, when all is said and done, my children will have been better for the things that I do to make their tomorrow better.
Well, that's I think that's the hope of every parent in the expectation of every child. So. We're getting, I can't put any more quarters in the wave streaming machine, Jody. We've been on this now for, well over an hour. See, I told you things would go pretty quickly and you wouldn't have to worry about it, right?
Once we get going. Well, this is a wonderful subject and it's so easy to talk about and there's lots to talk about. And we need to keep it relevant. So, yes, that was a video of Marilyn Monroe smoking pot.
You know what? I don't think that was. I don't think that was.
No, come on.
I don't think it was. I mean, I watched that thing probably, you know, not as many times as I would have watched it if she was naked, but I watched it 3 or 4 times, and it looked like a cigarette to me. That's just my deal. Not that I wouldn't say that she never smoked marijuana. I mean, she was hanging out with the Kennedy boys, and they were... But I just think that one particular video shows her. I think she's smoking a cigarette. Actually, I can tell by the way she held it, the way she took a drag, the way she exhaled. It looked like a cigarette puff, not a marijuana puff. But anyway,
or she was a really regular smoker.
Well, that's, you know, and if she was a real regular smoker, then that very perfectly rolled joint that she was smoking was either rolled by her or machine. That was the other dead giveaway. It looked like it was a very nice, if that was a joint, it was one of the best rolled joints I've ever seen. But anyway,
you know, I used to tell people, once prohibition of marijuana ends, you can look for J&J joints, hand rolled marijuana cigarettes, and find established instruments near you.
Well, you know what? I mean, maybe, but if you go to, like, I don't know if you've been to the Netherlands in Amsterdam, but they don't sell them. You know, they don't sell joints. They don't sell quantities. The transactional aspect of the purchase is like 3 or 4 grams. Now they provide rolling papers, and sometimes they don't anymore because you can't put tobacco in your pot and smoke it in the coffee houses and the like. But they provided. Pipes and paper, so it would be interesting to see how the marijuana distribution would be set up. Most people today buy far more than they need for a short period of time because they don't know when they're going to be able to buy it next, or if it's just going to dry up. So when you can buy it on a regular basis every day, I think people are going to be buying 2 or 3, 4 grams of this today, and next time they'll buy a different variety. I think that's where how the transaction will work in the distribution system there. But I'm going to give you the last word.
Perfectly civilized.
Well, God knows we try. I'm going to give you the last word here tonight, Jody, and you can riff on anything you want. And I want to thank you again for coming inside the Opium Den tonight and dealing with me and talking to our listeners. So. Again, thanks for that, and I'm going to give you the last word, Jody James.
Thank you. Well, when asked how we legalize drugs, we keep talking about it. We keep talking about it. Commit yourself to a one-minute rule. Don't know somebody for a minute unless you're bringing it up to them. Just keep talking about it. We're right. We're morally right, and we win.
Well, all right. I'm going to go with that, Jody. Again, thanks very much for coming inside the Opium Den tonight. And you can tell your children that well, the next, probably tomorrow or at the latest Saturday, this interview will be in our Opium Den archives, and they can go and download it and listen to Mom talk about drugs.
They stick it to their friends. Won't their grandma be proud?
Yes,
you
indeed.
Have a great night, Dan. I appreciate very much you inviting me to be here with you. And I appreciate the book you wrote, so don't let that not be the last thing.
Oh, did you get it in the mail yet? Did it come today?
I did, and I had an hour or so to flip through and look at some of it and read a couple paragraphs where I giggled out loud to my husband. So I really appreciate the effort and the energy that you put into that. And I think more people need to get out there and talk about these things. You are really nailing it. I was grateful to be here this evening.
Well, I was it was good for us as well, Jody. So you take care and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
You have a great night.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay. That was Jody James, a local Florida drug policy advocate. And we ran a little bit long tonight. I want to thank everybody if they've hung with us this long. And hope to see you back in inside the Opium Den next Thursday night. So until then, as we normally do, we'll leave you with the Opium Den motto, and that is, when good people obey bad law never changes. Good night.